The following message is by Pastor Andrew Beto, pastor of First Baptist Church of Orchard, Texas. More information on First Baptist Church Orchard can be found at fbcorchard.com.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to welcome you guys to the first Sunday of our 9-week marriage series entitled Real Marriage. We've got some new people in the congregation this morning, so I'm glad for everybody who's come. Over the next 9 weeks, we're going to be addressing the issues that affect Christian marriage in the world that we live in today. And I'm going to warn you, this is not going to be an easy series for me to preach, and it may not be an easy series to listen to. We're going to address some issues that, quite frankly, at church we sweep under the rug, that we don't talk about, that we don't deal with, because either they're embarrassing or they strike too close to home. Maybe they're too intimate. What happens is we talk so often in church about taking off our masks, right? Not wearing our church masks, right? The problem is when you take that church mask off, you don't always like the person you see. Sometimes you don't like the person you see in the mirror. Sometimes you don't like the person that sits across the pew from you. But we have to move through that discomfiture to get to the gold on the other side. See, what's happened in the past 100 years is that the world has hijacked these issues of marriage and sexuality and made them embarrassing for us to talk about. And so these things that are critical and fundamental to who we are and our effectiveness as Christians and people, we don't talk about. We let the world talk about. So we don't talk about marriage. We allow Cosmo to talk about marriage. And we allow CNBC to talk about marriage. And we allow talking heads on Fox News to talk about marriage. But we don't talk about it. And we don't talk about sex. We let the radio stations talk about it. We let our kids talk about it at school. We let movies talk about it. And we've lost the sense of what these things are supposed to be. And so we're going to deal with them. We're going to engage with them. And if I step on your toes, or if you have a problem, I would ask that you would come to me and talk to me. And we can talk through the issues. So with that being said, with that warning statement in place, I'm going to go ahead and jump right in. If you guys want my walking papers, just come on and tell me. It'll be all right. We'll have a business meeting.
Is it appropriate for children?
Yes, yeah. Okay. It's appropriate for children. This is probably, it's PG-13. It's good. We're good. It's nothing they're not going to see on daytime television.
Okay.
I've got a guilty secret that I want to tell you guys. It's something that I'm not proud of. It's something dirty, deep, and dark in my soul. I like romantic comedies. And I know that's not very manly, and I know that I'm going to be judged. You guys are going to look down on me. Realize I've shot machine guns, and I've blown stuff up, so I don't have anything to prove to anybody. If anybody wants to deal with me about it, we can go out in the parking lot. You may not win, but we'll deal with it, okay? I like romantic comedies. I like Sleepless in Seattle. I like You've Got Mail. Yeah, keep laughing. Keep laughing. Ha, ha, ha. It's really funny. And what I've seen with these romantic comedies, and it's a guilty pleasure because you watch them, and they're so stupid, and they're bad, and they don't resemble reality at all. It's like cotton candy for your brain. Like, I know this stuff is wrong, but it's like, oh, they found each other. Not that I'm crying, because I don't cry. You know, and you would get them on TV, and we get them in the movie theaters. Shane and I, for a long time, we've watched a show called How I Met Your Mother, and I know you're going to judge me, and it's going to be really bad. You know, I'm going to get letters. But we watch How I Met Your Mother, and it's funny, and we enjoy watching it. But in watching it, we see the really dysfunctional way that our culture deals with marriage and the idea of love. So I'm going to tell you two love stories today. I'm going to tell you two love stories, and we're going to kind of compare and contrast them. The first one is from How I Met Your Mother. And it's the story of Ted and Zoe. And if you guys have ever watched How I Met Your Mother, you know Ted is the main character. He's kind of this lovelorn guy, and he's always looking for the woman who's going to be his wife and all this kind of stuff. And you follow him through all these twists and turns. And one particular series of interactions, he finds this woman, Zoe. And they become friends, and their relationship grows. And there's only one problem. Zoe's married. Zoe's married to an older man. And so the relationship can't go anywhere. And so they become closer and closer friends. And you know where that's going. You can see. It's predictable. They fall in love, but she's married. And so Ted's going to be the good guy, and he's not going to do anything. And because they have to move the plot line forward, we start to see that the guy she's married to is not a good guy. And so it's okay when she decides to get divorced from him so that the story can move forward. And there's this touching moment where Ted and Zoe get together, and he's like, but I can't be with you because you're married. And she's like, no, it's okay. There's a silver lining. I'm getting divorced. Oh, and the crowd laughs and everything's great. And they hug and you roll the credits. See, she had a bad marriage, right? She didn't like her life. And the way she was going to fix it was by getting a different guy. She was going to get a different relationship. And this is the message that underlies all of the stories about romance in our culture. It's this idea that two people fall in love based on chemistry and fate. And if it's real and true, it's going to be easy, right? It'll just make sense. It'll just fit. And when it fails, it was just not meant to be. And everybody can walk away, and it's okay. Nobody gets hurt. There's no deep-seated, lifelong pain. There's no brokenness. See, what this means is that when you become tired of your spouse, it's okay to go seek your happiness someplace else. Because after all, the most important thing is that we're happy and that we follow our hearts. Unfortunately, this doesn't follow what Scripture tells us about marriage, and it doesn't follow what statistics tell us about marriage and life. See, what Scripture tells us is that marriage is this soul-level connection with another person, and you don't sever a soul-level connection with another person easily or cleanly. For anyone here who's ever been divorced, whoever has seen divorce or been involved in divorce, you know that it is a ripping, tearing, destructive process. It's never clean. And it's never really complete. You see, the lesson that we need to learn as we move forward with our spouses is we all have problems. Shannon and I have problems. Everybody has problems in their marriages. We don't need new spouses. What we need is new marriages with the same spouse. We need to change the interaction. So I'm going to tell you a different story now. I'm going to tell you a different love story. I'm going to tell you the story of a man named Hosea and his wife Gomer. See, God came to the prophet Hosea and he told him to go marry a prostitute. Scripture is very clear about what she was. She was a woman who went out, probably as a temple prostitute. And what you have to understand at the time was Israel had gone away from God. Solomon had several hundred wives, and he allowed the wives to bring in the worship of other gods, and they had built shrines all over Israel. And so the people had gotten to the point where they worshipped the Jewish god Yahweh, and they worshipped the Sumerian god Baal, and they worshipped the Assyrian god Ashtoreth. And it was okay. They were just, it was like we are today with our pluralistic culture where, you know, it's whatever you want to do. It's all right. If you want to go over here and worship on Sunday here, and then you want to go over to the temple and worship over there, that's cool. Whatever makes you feel good. To make things even worse, most of the worship of these gods was done through ritualized temple prostitution. Okay? That was the way that they worshiped. That's just how it worked. And this woman that Hosea is told to marry is a temple prostitute. So she is actively involved in the worship of other gods, and she's actively involved in sexual immorality. And not only did he tell her that she was going to be this way, he told Hosea that she was going to continue to be unfaithful to him. That not only had she been like this, but she would continue to be like this, and she would become pregnant with several other men's babies, and she would continue to cheat on him throughout the lifespan of the marriage. And he was to do this to show the people what God saw from the Israelites. And so they get married, and they have three children. And the first child, God tells Hosea to marry, or to call Jezreel. And Jezreel means God sows, which is good. God scatters. But way more appropriately, it is the name of a valley that was the site of every major battle in the Jewish nation. It was one of these central corridors to get from Assyria down to Egypt, to get from Egypt out to Mesopotamia. So it was where all the armies would go. And so if you were going to fight a battle, it was probably going to be on the plains of Jezreel. And so when the people heard the name Jezreel, they equated it with bloodshed. They equated it with violence and danger and conquest and enemies. It would be like naming a child Chernobyl or naming a child Fallujah, right? It has those kind of overtones. And God's very clear. I want you to name the child Jezreel because I will inflict bloodshed on the Israeli people. On the nation of Israel, I will inflict fire, sword, and death. He's going to punish Israel. And so the second child that comes is a daughter, and her name is Lo Ruhamah. And that's a horrible name for a little girl. How would you like to name your little girl not loved? That's what it means. It means not loved. And you got to think about yourself. If you were in my congregation, I'm named my daughter not loved, you'd be like, what are you doing? What kind of a horrible person are you? And so the people heard this terrible name, and they whispered to one another, Hosea's wife is unfaithful, and the child isn't his. And he gave it this horrible name, Lo Ruhamah, to which Hosea would respond, do you trouble yourself with Lo Ruhamah? I tell you, trouble yourself with your relationship to God, because Yahweh has turned his back on you. God is telling the people that because of their unfaithfulness, he will stop loving them. And in fact, the third child that he has, they named Lo Ami, which basically means not mine. It's like naming your child, not mine. This one in mine. Hosea must openly proclaim to the people in the town that he lives that this is not his child. And not only that, when God says, you will name him not mine, because these are not my people, and I am not their God. See, at this point, God has said, I'm done. I'm out. I'm done with these people. We're done here. And very quickly, Gomer does the same thing. She leaves her husband, she leaves her kids, and she goes and lives the wild life. She trips the life fantastic. Moving from guy to guy, from lover to lover, until finally they grow tired with her. And at some point, she's sold into slavery. And so the story comes to a close at the end of chapter 1 with Gomer humiliated, naked, standing in the town square, getting ready to be sold to somebody else. She has humiliated her husband, shamed her children, and now she's being displayed for sale totally naked. In the same way, Israel has sold itself to these other gods, to the worship of these created beings. And it is about to be stripped and defeated and violated by the Assyrian army, who will overrun the land and take everybody away, deport all of the people, and they will never come home. Her cities will be burned, her people will be killed. And that's where we're left. And if that's the way we were left, this would be a horrible story. And you guys would leave here and go, what is he talking about? Why would you start a marriage sermon series that way? Fortunately, that's not the way the story ends. See, Israel and Gomer both wanted new relationships with someone new. But what they really needed was to have new relationships with the same person. Israel needed a new covenant with the same God. And Gomer needed a new marriage with the same spouse. See, sometimes the new and exciting is this huge draw to us, and the worst punishment that we can receive is the object of our heart's desire. But God doesn't leave us there. He doesn't leave us at the bottom of the pit. He doesn't leave us with the consequences of our actions. And so, it's not the end of the story for Hosea, Gomer, or Israel. See, because God comes to Hosea and he says, I know you've been through this horrible experience and you've been violated and you've been humiliated and she left and just ripped your heart apart. But you need to go back and you need to redeem her. See, she broke his heart and the covenant of their marriage in a gross and public way, and he has to go down to the public square and in front of all of his friends and all of the people that he knows, he has to go back and admit to them that he now has to buy his wife back. That he had so little control over his family, he was such a bad husband, that he now has to go and pay money to redeem his wife. And so he goes into the public square and he endures the shame. And he listens to the men talking behind their hands about him. And on the other end, we see Gomer standing naked and alone up there, being displayed for all to see, left with the consequences of her actions, her shame. She knows that she shamed her family. She shamed the only man that's ever loved her. And that she has no hope of redemption. In fact, her family's not going to come and redeem her. If she's lucky, her family won't come and stone her to death. And then she hears that she's been purchased. And she prepares herself for the abuse and degradation that is about to happen. But then something happens, because the only man that's ever truly loved her comes through the crowd. And he comes up to her, and he takes off his cloak, and he covers her nakedness with it. And he says, I've paid the price for you. I've redeemed you. Now come home. He's paid her debt in full. She is, in a word, redeemed. See, Hosea didn't change his spouse. He changed his marriage. He based his marriage on redemption. He based his marriage on forgiveness and on change. He had a new marriage with the same spouse. And if we want our marriages to change, we have to stop looking at our spouse as the problem. And we've got to stop looking at how we're going to find something better out there, something different out there, and start figuring out how we're going to change the relationship. We've got to figure out how we're going to change the dynamic. And the way we begin to change that dynamic is by changing ourselves. See, the first place that you need to look when you repair your marriage isn't at your spouse, and it's not at the world, it's at yourself in the mirror. When we read this story, the danger is to see ourselves as Hosea, and we're not Hosea. We're Gomer. All of us are Gomer. This isn't about the wicked woman and the man who come. That's not what this is about, guys. This is about all of us who have sold ourselves at the altar of the world. See, Gomer had been unfaithful to her husband. Israel had been unfaithful to her king. And we are daily unfaithful to our God. Every day, we cheat by worshiping money, by worshiping our job, by worshiping our kids, by worshiping sexuality or the world. We look at the loving Creator in the eye and we spit in His face every day. And we earn the penalty for our sin. But the message of Hosea is that God doesn't leave us in our sin. He doesn't leave us there. We're the ones standing naked on the auction block, shamed and exposed. And God comes to us and He covers our shame with His glory. And He buys us back with the sacrifice of His Son. He redeems us. He loves us so much that He buys us from the consequences of our actions with His own blood. That's the God we serve. That's the lesson that we learn. That's the change that has to happen. Our marriages are supposed to mirror this relationship, this reality. That's what we do. That's where the glorification of God comes from. See, marriages are not fairy tales with happy endings. Marriages are flawed people loving broken people through the power of a holy God. It's not supposed to be easy. They're not supposed to be perfect. Nobody's perfect. Everybody in here deserves to be divorced. I've done things in my life that deserve to be divorced. Lots of them. Right? Ask my wife. I'm not a gem. Okay? My wife loves me sacrificially. She loves me in spite of the garbage that I bring to the table. Right? That's the secret here. The secret is, it's not about your needs. It's not about your wants or your hurts or all of the stuff inside you. It's about the relationship between your wife and you, between your husband and you. It's about God's glory and you learning to sacrificially love another person. See, you can't put Christ into the center of your marriage until He is at the center of your life. And so I would tell you this. If you're here today because you want to fix your marriage, let me tell you the single biggest thing that you can do to fix your marriage. You can hit your knees and you can ask Christ to come into your life and accept the salvation for your sins. That's the biggest single thing. Because if you don't do that, you can't do any of the other stuff. If you are not saved, if you're not born again, if you haven't had the penalty of your sin paid for, you are never, never going to be able to sacrificially love your spouse the way that you're called to. Now, you may have a worldly marriage. You can roll the dice. Maybe you're one of the 49% that isn't going to get broke up. Maybe. We'll see. But I know for me, if I wasn't saved, I couldn't be married. There's no way. My wife wasn't saved. There's no way we'd still be married. I'd be drunk underneath an overpass someplace, panhandling. I'm not kidding. This isn't me joking. That's real. We can't fix our marriages until we fix ourselves and our relationship with God. See, once we've allowed God into our hearts to recreate us, then we can start this process of fixing these marriages and renewing these relationships. See, we need to take these marriages and put Christ at the center of them. And we put Christ at the center of them by turning them away from the world and towards God. Which means that we need to understand that when we are ransomed by God, we become new creations. When we dedicate our marriages to God, we make our marriages new creations. And this means that we have to ignore the things that the world says about marriage and life together and focus on what God says about marriage and life together. This means that you've got to stop listening to the broken people in your life who are giving you broken, bad advice. I love parents, okay? I love my parents. And I'm not saying be disrespectful to your parents. But if your parents don't have their marriages under control, if they can't manage their own life, they don't need to be giving you advice on your marriages. If you get broken advice from broken people, your life is going to be broken. Some of the biggest problems that we have in marriages are parents who will not allow their children to be married. Who want to be the most important person in their life, not their child's spouse. And I got a little girl and I got a little boy, and I know I'm going to be horrible about that when I get older. I know. I'm just admitting it to you now. That's going to be something that I struggle with, and people are going to have to hold me accountable. Well, you've got to stop listening to your friends. If you got somebody that you work with and you start talking to them about your husband or your wife, you're like, oh man, she's crazy. You know, she's crazy. Probably, but so are you. And what are they going to tell you? No, man, you're all messed up. You're a jackwagon. Get out of here. No, they're going to be like, oh no, you're right, man. She's crazy. No, he's not treating you right. You don't need that. Come out drinking with me. Right? That's not good advice. Why would you surround yourself with that? Why would you listen to that? And you got to stop listening to the world. Look, there is nothing in a romance novel that's going to teach you anything about intimacy. And I don't care how attractive the covers are, nothing in Maxim is going to make your marriage better. There's no advice in Maxim. I was deployed. I was a Marine. I've read lots of Maxim. There's nothing in there that's going to fix your marriage. Okay? Just get that off the table. This isn't an easy fix, and it's not a quick fix, and it's not something that you can get in a 10-point package that somebody emails to you. If anybody has ever been to a chiropractor here, they know what an adjustment is, right? Nick's been to a chiropractor. He's kept him in business, right? When they do an adjustment, they basically like wrench your body out of shape and break you and do all kinds of horrible things, and you pay them a lot of money and they abuse you. What they do is they return your body to its original shape, what you're supposed, the kind of posture you're supposed to have. And everybody says the same thing. Oh, I went and I got my adjustment and I felt really good for a couple of days and then it wore off. And if you talk to a chiropractor, they'll say, yeah, you spent your entire life in the wrong posture, you know, slumping or slouching or dealing with this, and your body isn't used to it. And so your muscles aren't where they need to be, and so you'll go back into the hunched shape that you were in. And so you've got to keep going back, and you've got to keep getting readjusted, and it's a painful process. It's something you have to work on as you get these muscles to stretch back and build up to the point where you can actually be normal. And what we have to realize is that in our marriages, in our lives, we are not normal. We are not where we're supposed to be. We're hunched and broken and misshapen because of 20, 30, 40 years of bad decisions and dysfunctionality. And fixing the problem isn't something where you're like, oh, I went to this marriage conference, I spent 2 days, and now I'm fixed. Now I'm all better. Now I'm a great person. It's something you work at every day. It's a painful process that takes time. It has to be a priority. It has to be a priority. But I don't have time, Pastor. I don't have time. Hey, man, we're all busy. You think I'm not busy? You think I don't know what busy is? I know what busy is. But let me tell you something. If you don't make your marriage a priority, your marriage is going to make itself a priority. It'll make itself a priority. and you'll end up taking time off of work to go to divorce court. Or you'll end up taking time off of work to go to visitations. So it's going to be a priority one way or another. It depends on how you're going to make it a priority. It's got to be a bigger priority than your hobbies. Guys, let me just speak to guys, because guys are the ones that have hobbies. If you're having problems in your marriage, your new hobby is fixing your marriage. Before sports or activities or organizations, those are all great things. But if you got a broke down marriage, you can't do any of that stuff. It's got to be more important than entertainment. You know, I like TV. Right? I watch a little TV with my wife. I like to go see movies. Guess what? If you don't have time to work on your marriage, you ain't got time for Dancing with the Stars. Joe, no Dancing with the Stars. Okay? And this sounds harsh, right? This is like, oh, Pastor, you can't mean that. You can't. Absolutely, I mean that. If you don't have time to talk to your wife for 30 minutes, you better turn the TV off. You better turn it off. You better turn Dancing with the Stars off. You better turn off The Bachelor. Whatever you're watching, you better turn it off and talk to your spouse. Okay, and now I'm going to make everybody mad in here. Working on your marriage is more important than your kids. What, Pastor? My kids? Yes, your kids. Let me tell you something. Missing a season of Little League so that you can work on your marriage, the only long-term effect it's going to have on your kids is there's one less trophy that their wife is going to have to throw out when they're 30. I got a box of trophies in my garage, and I don't ever go out there and be like, oh, I remember this when I played soccer in seventh grade. Oh, I can never live without it. You fix your marriages. And that's the best thing you can do for your kids. Let me tell you, having a dad who sacrificially loves his wife is the single best thing you can do for a daughter. It beats gymnastics, it beats softball or any of the other things. You fix your marriage. It is very tempting as we talk about this to think that this is something we can muscle. Right? That we're going to do this on our own. This is my problem. I'm going to fix my problem. You can't fix this problem. And you know why? Because you can fix yourself and you can point your marriage towards God, but you can't fix your spouse. You are not going to nag your husband into being a better person. I don't care how much you try. He's going to get tired. Maybe he'll shut up and he won't listen to what you're saying. But he's not a better person and he hasn't changed. Trust me. My wife nags me plenty. And I'm not changed. You have got to take this stuff to God. See, our God is in the life change business. He's in the redemption business. That's what he does. That's what he does. And he changes people. He changes people. I know because I changed. Look, my wife's been praying for me since I was a freshman in college. And if you'd have seen me when I was a freshman in college, I was a different person. I was a different person. I went from being somebody who was not saved, angry, drank a lot, chased the ladies, to somebody who was sort of an okay Christian, maybe still drank a lot, still chased ladies. And I've changed over time. I've gotten closer to God. I've lost interest in things that weren't good for me. And I would love to tell you it's because I'm a great guy. You know, I'm a great guy, but I'm not. My wife did this to me. I used to never pray. I never pray. We got married. She was like, I want to pray together. And I told her, yeah, not so much. I don't really want to do that. She's like, I really want to pray. So then she left me alone and she prayed about it. And then I started praying with her. And then I was in a long prayer and she'd do the long prayers because she's a Baptist and I was Episcopalian and we don't really pray so much. And she'd do like the long drawn out, and I'd do the thing where I'd like halfway through, I'd go, like, seriously, really? 15-minute prayer, Shannon? Is that what we're going to do? It's 10 o'clock at night? Over time, her prayers have changed me, and they continue to change me. So if you got a hard case husband at home, if you got a hard case husband or wife here with you that you brought to church this morning, prayer changes people. Prayer can change people. God redeems. He changes and he rebuilds. And we have to have the patience and the grace to allow God to change our marriages. Because if we do that, then we really will have a new marriage with the same spouse. You guys would bow your heads with me, please.